Hello, and welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Nick Carey, co-founder and vice chairman of Blockchain.com. Here at Blockchain.com, we believe in the potential of blockchain technology to improve the state of the world. While cryptocurrencies can radically transform community access to financial products and services, the core technology of public ledgers can be used to build novel applications underpinned by transparency. In our latest podcast segment, Blockchain for Good, we're unearthing contemporary examples of how blockchain technology is making a real-world difference to people, communities, and charities all around the world. We'll learn more about organizations and projects using crypto and blockchain technology to promote social and economic inclusion and sustainability efforts. KPMG recently published a report looking at the environmental, social, and governance impact of Bitcoin and its role in the ESG imperative. To discuss this report in more detail, today we're joined by Brian Consalvo, technology risk principal at KPMG, who co-authored the report along with Kirk Patrick Karin, ESG climate advisory director at KPMG. So Brian, we're so excited to have you on board with us today. We have a little tradition around here, so we need to learn, how did you earn your first buck?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nick. So in terms of my first dollar, I guess I go back to when I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. My grandfather was starting to get a bit too old to cut the grass. So I offered to do it, and he paid me, I think it was $10 to cut the grass, the front and the back. It's funny because I remember at the time, you know, $10 kind of seemed like it was a good bit of money for that age, but times have certainly changed.
I love that. So grandparents putting kids to work in the backyard, definitely a good way to learn a little bit about discipline and mending the yard. So thank you for sharing that. All right. So talk to us a little bit about what your role involves at KPMG.
So KPMG, we're structured into three primary groups. We have audit, tax, and advisory. I'm a partner in our advisory practice and focus on technology risk management, which is with a focus on financial service companies and also working with some crypto native companies. Additionally, I lead one of our emerging technology COEs, which is where we've spent a good bit of time over the past few years focusing on crypto-related content.
All right. Well, thank you. So let's talk a little bit about this moniker ESG. What does the ESG framework kind of matter? Like, why does it matter to business? And also, what does it stand for?
Well, ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. And like you said, it's basically a corporate responsibility framework that I think encourages companies to look beyond just their bottom line and really take some initiatives to do things that benefit society, you know, more broadly. You know, obviously a big focus around ESG is the environmental aspect that has pushed companies to reduce their carbon footprint. Additionally, you know, it's something that a lot of investors have started to look at prior to deploying their own capital, which I think further incentivizes companies to take action in this space.
All right, let's talk a little bit about this. So why did KPMG decide to author a report on Bitcoin's role in the ESG imperative?
Great question. This seems to be the question that everyone likes to ask right now. So as I mentioned, I lead one of our emerging tech COEs, and I've been giving some thought as to, you know, like what could we put out as our next piece. And if I kind of rewind, you know, I started working on the paper probably about a year ago. And at the time, we had just done a State of Crypto webcast back in, I think, December 2022 following, you know, the FTX fallout. So it's time to start thinking about what are we going to do next? For me, I'd started to come across just so many different examples that, you know, seem to intersect between both Bitcoin and ESG. And I think those examples were really ones that weren't widely known. So, for example, you know, most people that aren't familiar with Bitcoin are usually, you know, taken aback when you tell them that Bitcoin could help incentivize, help with the transition to renewable energy. Additionally, I think, you know, there were still a number of misconceptions about Bitcoin that I thought could be outlined well in the paper. And I think that's just where it took off from.
Well, I think maybe your research and some of the efforts that were contributed to by your team have really sparked an impressive dialogue. I mean, I think when the report came out, it trended on Twitter, and at least that's where I ran across it the first time. And I was so intrigued to sort of see all the findings put in one place. These are things that I've picked out over the years. But I think putting them all together in a succinct way and really addressing head on some of the, you know, kind of big concerns and criticisms that people have about Bitcoin have been really interesting. And let's dig into a few of those. I think some of the key findings in the report deserve a bit of assessment. So Bitcoin is frequently criticized for being energy consumptive. So can you help put maybe this into context for our listeners and also talk a little bit about what you've learned to be the environmental considerations as it relates to Bitcoin mining, and also define that for anyone that doesn't know what it is?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say Bitcoin's energy consumption, or the consumption used by the miners, is usually about as far as most of the critics will go. And I think that's usually what kind of finds its way into various headlines. And while I do agree that, you know, it definitely does use quite a bit of energy, I think it's far more important to look at the emissions rather than the energy consumption. What I mean by that is, when it comes to emissions, you primarily have two types. You have scope one and you have scope two emissions. Scope one is essentially the direct emissions from, you know, on-site combustion of fuels. So if you think about cars, trucks, planes, lawnmowers, those all have scope one emissions from the fuel that they burn. On the other hand, you have scope two, and those are basically indirect emissions from fuel sources that, you know, are used to generate electricity. And this is typically what people point to as it relates to Bitcoin mining's environmental, you know, impact, despite the fact that miners are running off electricity. So they don't actually use fuel or have any scope one emissions. But electricity really requires energy to produce it. And this oftentimes comes from fossil fuels or natural gas. And I think, you know, what I really find interesting is, like, so many people tout, you know, electric vehicles as being zero emissions, but then they're very quick to turn around and criticize Bitcoin mining, despite the fact that it's only using electricity. So I think, you know, the other data point I found to be extremely fascinating is that the fashion industry is actually one of the biggest contributors to global emissions. Same goes for clothes dryers, which actually have about the same indirect or scope two emissions as Bitcoin mining. So I think, to me, it's not so much a matter of reducing our consumption in these areas. It's about people reducing consumption in areas that, you know, really don't interest them, or things that they don't see as being a legitimate use of electricity. So we could all easily probably get rid of our dryers and hang our clothes up to dry. Sure, it'd be a huge inconvenience, but it would reduce emissions and wouldn't require, you know, government subsidies to fund it either. But I think, with all that being said, what we outline a number of different examples of how Bitcoin mining can have a positive impact on the environment. But I think the one that really stood out to me was the use of methane gas at landfills, and even the use of flared gas at oil and gas fields. So methane, for those that may not know, is one of the biggest contributors to climate change. So if I think about the low-hanging fruit, this is probably one that I would put the most time and energy into, and one that I found to be pretty fascinating, especially since, you know, it doesn't require any changes to human behavior. Most recently, one of the big public miners announced a pilot program to do this in a landfill in Utah. I mean, that could have profound impacts on reducing emissions. Now, my understanding is, you know, the infrastructure required to do that is a bit challenging. It's probably easier said than done, but I think it'd be really interesting to see how this plays out over time, and if, you know, other miners can follow suit and really, you know, do this at scale.
Brian, it's so refreshing to hear that, and also just important to contextualize what are always seemingly sort of sensational headlines about the energy consumption of the Bitcoin network. I don't think anyone debates that it's energy consumptive. It's just, where does that energy come from? And then digging into that a bit more. And I think one of the most interesting things about Bitcoin is we actually have a lot more transparency into the energy, the mixture of the energy that's going in to securing the Bitcoin network. And ultimately, the network benefits by this energy consumption by making it more and more difficult to essentially change or modify the integrity of all the transaction history in Bitcoin. And so basically, the more energy it consumes, the more decentralized and more secure the network becomes over time. And actually, as of this month, the Bitcoin network now has an all-time high in its hash rate, meaning the network is more secure than at any point in its operating history. It's also never had a meaningful, significant protocol breach. And so those things are all important. I guess it's just to put a little bit more context on that, you know, people oftentimes criticize the individual consumption of energy, whether it's for using PlayStations or hair dryers or drying machines or whatever it is. And I'm not always sure that's that useful, because a lot of the energy today that is being used by both those tools that we have in our day-to-day lives, but also the Bitcoin network, is coming from renewable energy sources. And the two examples you provided are so good too, which is we can actually capture and burn off harmful methane gas at the source of those things, whether it's at a flaring site or, more interestingly, at these landfills, by installing basically remote mining facilities for Bitcoin. And so not only can you potentially even finance the capture of methane, but also finance the investment of renewable energy sites to use crypto in a way that you know, is really a novel kind of investment system for doing so. So anyway, it's a lot more nuanced than the headlines would frequently make you believe, and it's worth basically moving from that scope one to scope two and broadening one's aperture and perspective on the energy consumption.
Yeah, and I think just to add on to that, one of the points that we called out in the report is there was a study done. I think it came from the Harvard Business Review that highlighted the fact there is enough flared gas that Bitcoin miners could use between the United States and Canada to power the entire Bitcoin network.
I mean, and right now that stuff's just venting into the
atmosphere. And a lot of that stuff is, like you said, it's being flared, and the amount of greenhouse gases that are reduced from flaring is not 100%. So like the flaring is better than just releasing the methane directly into the environment. But I think it's only about, 60% efficient. And then I think you get into certain other variables like wind, which can make it much more difficult to burn off that methane, which means if you can start using Bitcoin miners around the globe to mine with flared gas, I mean, you could make huge strides in reducing overall emissions.
Yep. I'm looking forward to those types of crossover projects, and I think there are going to be a lot of them that come to market over the next few years. And I know there's a lot of financing basically chasing these types of novel opportunities. So one of the main pillars of ESG is the second letter S, standing for social, meaning the use of the technology for good, the access to it, and the broader objective of maybe building a more inclusive economy. How does Bitcoin stack up here when you think about the S in the ESG framework?
Well, for starters, Bitcoin is global and open source. So anyone with an internet connection around the world can use it without permission, I think, which makes it an extremely inclusive technology and asset class. I think it allows everyone to be their own bank as well and really hold an asset that isn't an IOU. I think that's something that a lot of people take for granted these days, just by the way we've all grown up and the way our existing kind of financial system works. But I forget the exact number. I think we have over 1 billion people in the world without a bank account. And I think that's a very profound statistic. The other thing Bitcoin enables is cross-border payments that settle in near real time. And so I always love to give the example that I once heard, that if you wanted to send a wire to someone in Australia, for example, you could literally drive to your local ATM, pull out the cash, drive to the airport, fly to Australia, take a taxi or Uber, go to your friend's house, and then hand deliver the cash quicker than it would take to get an actual wire to them. It would also be a hell of a lot cheaper. Additionally, there are a number of challenges that developing countries face when dealing with traditional payment systems, where I think Bitcoin provides a more efficient means of moving value without even having to leave your home and only need an internet connection to do so. So to me, I give those two examples just to kind of highlight the differences between the way payments work on Bitcoin network versus traditional payment rails.
Yeah, I think those are so good. I mean, one of the key sort of value propositions of Bitcoin as proposed in the original white paper was essentially to build an electronic peer-to-peer cash system for the internet.
Yep.
Essentially having a tool set that would enable anyone, sort of regardless of the circumstances of their birth, to be able to do things like send, receive, secure, in exchange, digital forms of wealth. And I think while many people in the world benefit from, robust financial infrastructure, especially, in Europe and the United States, that's not really the case, like you mentioned, across broad swaths of the earth. And so by building a financial system that's more inclusive, you basically build a bigger pie. And if you have a bigger pie with more people trading and exchanging goods, it's a rising tide that raises all ships. And so one of the key, I think, sort of arguments for why Bitcoin is sort of addressing a major social gap in the financial services space, is just that it's almost impossible to go build, you know, brick and mortar branches of a high street or a main street bank in all of these jurisdictions, all these locations, and broadly anywhere that the internet can get to. And so basically, if you can make it possible for the internet to exchange precious information with someone else, well, then you've got this whole new capability, global financial inclusion. Those are noble causes, I think, that really stand up to the social pillar of the ESG initiative. So definitely some interesting points there. Okay, let's move on to the G. G stands for governance. In many ways, Bitcoin and crypto projects set a completely different standard in this area, as these projects, as you mentioned, are open source versus centralized organizations or businesses. So what does good governance mean in the traditional sense? And what does it sort of mean in the context of a decentralized or open source initiative?
I've always described governance as it relates to Bitcoin as being, you know, inherently built into the protocol. So what's great about the governance of Bitcoin is that it's open source, like I mentioned before, but everyone can see what the rules are. No one can abuse those rules because it's decentralized. And I think because everything is governed by the protocol, there's no human intervention, you know, where someone could make a decision unilaterally or something that they shouldn't be doing. If you think of companies that have historically gotten themselves into trouble, especially for bad governance, it's usually some sort of incentive that is encouraging them to do something they shouldn't. You literally cannot do that in Bitcoin. I think it's something that's really important. So this is probably one of the more nascent things that people come across, you know, when learning about Bitcoin, but it's also something we've seen previously. If you think about the way we send data over the internet, the protocol we're all using to do that is TCP/IP. So if someone were to use a different protocol, they wouldn't be able to send and receive data unless others started to use that modified protocol as well. But we don't all oftentimes think about how TCP/IP works, but that is the general concept. It's very similar to how Bitcoin works. And this, in Bitcoin, this is accomplished by, you know, tens of thousands of individual nodes running the exact same Bitcoin software. So I can go in and change one of the rules if I want on my computer, but it's basically my local copy, and the rest of the network would no longer recognize or be able to interact with me. The other point to highlight around governance is the Block Wars example, where, you know, there was a huge debate on whether block sizes should be increased, to allow more throughput, help Bitcoin scale. And it resulted in an entirely new protocol and asset being created, but actual Bitcoin, as we know today, has remained unchanged. I think had those block wars been something that played out with, say, a centralized company, I think people in power could have changed it, and who knows how things would have turned out.
Yeah, it's such an important point. And I think one of the interesting things about open source protocols is they basically bake in a completely different way for changes to be implemented in the infrastructure layer of these technologies. And so instead of having a company that's running those things, you essentially have all of these contributors all over the world, just like the Wikipedia project has many editors from all over the world contributing to the integrity of the articles that are written there. The same is true of the instruction sets that are proposed as potential improvements to these open source projects. And these projects are extraordinarily conservative, I think that's a good thing. You, in good governance, you basically want to have a lot of predictability. You want to have a fiduciary duty to the integrity of the system. And the governance of these open source projects has, for the last decade, demonstrated a pretty novel coordination capability. And so definitely something that I think speaks to the strength of, the governance and the ESG imperative of Bitcoin. So was there anything in your research that, you know, was like ultimately like really surprising to you that came up in your findings that, you didn't think, you maybe had some preconceived notions about things being different?
Yeah, there definitely was. I think the coolest thing I came across was the work being done in rural Africa to help provide electricity to various villages and that don't have the power infrastructure that, like I said, many of us take for granted. So they rely on these things called microgrids for their electricity. And these are basically projects that come with a number of issues that make the power far more expensive and oftentimes intermittent, but Bitcoin miners have been able to co-locate next to these microgrids to really provide a primary consumer of this electricity throughout the day, which in turn has significantly increased the economics of these microgrid projects. And it's also helped to reduce the cost of electricity for the actual villages where these microgrids reside. I think the other interesting thing I'll point to, which I had, like you said, I had some preconceived notions about, but definitely went a bit deeper in the paper, was Bitcoin's use in illicit and illegal activities. I think this is another big misconception about what it's used for, when it's actually used far less than traditional payments for illegal and illicit activity. I was at a conference a few months ago where the CTO of one of the big on-chain analytics companies, who was a former director of the FBI, gave a really good presentation describing why using Bitcoin, or really any other crypto for that matter, makes it much easier for the FBI, the Department of Justice, et cetera, to track these payments because Bitcoin is a public, transparent ledger. It also reduces the amount of time before their investigations can get going because they don't have to wait around to get subpoenas. I think that's a process that probably requires a lot of red tape and takes time to do and get approval. I think that's an area where I would really encourage people to read up on, because it's probably not the view the average person outside of this space actually has.
Those are both really good examples. Again, I think it's been a headline that's sort of easy to publish, but if you look beyond the sensationalism, every single intelligence agency speaks, quite positively about their tooling and their ability to essentially investigate illicit activity on these networks. And the global adoption of digital currencies in illicit activity is lower than in traditional payment systems, and especially cash.
That's right.
And that's because cash is a truly untraceable instrument versus things like Bitcoin, where every time you make a payment on the internet, it gets stored in that blockchain, and that gets stored forever.
Yep.
And your digital fingerprint is attached to that. Now it's pseudonymous, but if your identity gets attached to that transaction in any way, shape, or form, your entire financial graph can really be exposed. I think this is going to bring some important conversations to the front of privacy and the internet over the coming years, and it'll actually maybe come around full circle, where we'll talk a little bit more about potentially improving the privacy of these transactional networks as more people move meaningful amounts of their daily and annual consumption through them. But again, that will require a bit more adoption to happen. So both of those examples you provided were super interesting. Okay, so let's talk a bit about, from your perspective in having written the report, what more can the broader crypto community and the Bitcoin community do to focus on improving, improving sort of metrics across ESG criteria? I mean, in some ways, the major institutions on Wall Street have just approved a variety of exchange-traded funds. The ETFs now are live, which is, I think, a pretty meaningful endorsement of this asset class, specifically for Bitcoin and likely other cryptocurrencies in the future. But I don't think you're ever going to be done making improvements to environmental, social, and governance-related criteria. And so what are some things, in your view, the crypto community could concentrate on or address that would maybe broaden their appeal to the public?
Yeah, so like you said, I think the ETFs are going to be a big turning point for the industry, because I think you're just going to, again, start to get a lot more eyes on this space, because I think for the past year or so, it's been very quiet. I think there's still a lot of education that needs to be done. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions about what Bitcoin's used for, how it's used, its energy consumption, all of these things we talked about. I mean, hell, I always give the example, when I first started getting into this space, I was very quick to dismiss it because I thought it was some kind of magic internet money. But the more I started to research and really put in some time and effort to understand it, you realize that this thing is actually really helping to solve various problems and enable people, like I said, in unbanked jurisdictions and people without access to efficient payment rails. It's providing a lot of value there. I think we still really have to differentiate between Bitcoin, the asset class, and Bitcoin, the technology, from the crypto community. Obviously, like the events of 2022, highlighted by the fall of some big name companies, I think that left a black eye on the industry. But fraud is not something that is specific to Bitcoin. And I think a lot of people still make those two parallels where they hear about it and they're like, oh, well, Bitcoin's just used for fraud. Look at what happened with, you know, XYZ company. I mean, even look at the Bernie Madoff scheme. That wasn't really that long ago, but I don't think we then say, okay, there was a massive fraud took place, so let's not, you know, have similar businesses. I think you just need proper governance in place at these companies to ensure that they aren't able to commit fraud. There was a really good example someone that I work with gave on a webcast we did, where when you go back to early 2000s and Enron went bankrupt due to fraud, like there wasn't, you didn't have people then say, okay, well, we don't want to touch energy anymore, or we don't want to trade energy, just because the company that was doing so was the ones that made the mistakes. So I think just, I think we really just need to look and see what regulation we could potentially get. There's obviously a number of bills that are in draft form right now, but I think really finding a good balance between good governance, good regulation, but not so much so that it could potentially stifle innovation. I think that's going to be the big key for this year and near term.
Yeah, I think striking that balance has always been, crucial for consumer protection, but also enabling an innovative economy. And so, you know, for people that are interested in learning a little bit more, where can they download this report? I think, Brian, there'll be a lot of people that listening to this would like to get their hands on it and look at it in their spare time. So what's the best place for them to find your report?
So the report is very easy to find. I think if you Google KPMG Bitcoin, it should be the first result that pops up. So it's free to download. So I encourage all of your readers, if they haven't, to take a look at it. My contact information's in there. I'm also fairly active on LinkedIn, so that's probably the best place to find me if anyone has any follow-up questions.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Brian. We'll make sure we include that in the show notes. We really appreciate your time today, and thank you for joining the blockchain.com podcast. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and share this podcast. And we'll look forward to catching up with Brian again in the future. I'm sure we'll see more of his research, and we'll have to get him back on the podcast to interrogate him more about his most recent discovery. So thanks again, Brian.
Thank you, Nick.
Remember to subscribe to our channel and leave us a review if you enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Carey, and on behalf of the entire blockchain.com team, thank you for tuning in. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are for institutional and informational purposes only and should not be considered as financial advice. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and consult with a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions. Thank you.